Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordeni, your host. On Book Spectrum, we like to interview not only the seasoned authors, but we really like to talk to first-time writers and people who have books out from various occupations around the spectrum. I have one such man with me today who's kind of on both those levels here. Many of us have wondered what an alien civilization might discover about us long after the extinction of humanity, as well as what might lead to society's demise. Ishinobu explores this from foreign planet scholars' point of view in his new book, The Story of Humanity, Ecology, and Consequence. He is with me now. Ishinobu, thanks for joining us on Book Spectrum, and welcome.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
This book I found interesting. I really love world history. I'm a world history guy. I love ancient history. I like reading books about everything from the possibility of aliens stopping in and influencing early cultures. This is all fascinating to me. This may be the first book of its kind where scholars from another planet, like we could be doing this on when our society, or if our society gets advanced enough to do this, we could be doing such a thing. But this is about another society or another planet's beings coming to Earth, seeing a barren existence here, at least a humanless existence, and kind of piecing together through looking at what we left behind, our own history. I find that fascinating.
The book is hypothetically written, as the preface says, by the scribes of Sculptor. Sculptor is an actual galactic system that's around around 1.8 light years away. And the reason I took this device was, in other words, to make it the book appear as being a historical document from the future, is in order to convey, exactly as you said, how aliens would view humanity. In other words, how we would think about it is an objective look. Because being human, we are stuck to our way of thinking. We're in societies. We have cultural reference points. And this book tries to divorce and take an unbiased look at human existence.
Ishii, this is almost like what we do when we try to look at ancient societies from our point of view. Obviously, we can only rely on their writings, whatever art they leave behind, and of course, the artifacts and buildings. This is what this other society is doing with us.
There's a considerable difference when we look at ancient civilization. In my reading of histories, rather consistently, we tend to look past ancient civilizations in light of the morality that and the cultural norms that we have at the current time. For example, when we talk about slavery and how we treat others, we tend to take the modern view and accept that as being correct. Ancients had a much different view, Aristotle included, as I mentioned in the book, on, as Aristotle said, some people are born to rule, others are born to be slaves. Well, we don't think that way anymore.
But it was the mentality back then. Ishinobu is with me on Book Spectrum. His book is The Story of Humanity, Ecology and Consequence. It also, in a way, is your take, or it seems to be your take on how things evolved over the years and kind of how we might be able to destroy ourselves. I know it's not a pleasant thing to think about sometimes, but we've often had the discussion, whether it be something natural, something we're doing, pollution, or even the possibility of technology. I'm not going to say you attack technology from this alien society's point of view, but you say that, and I tend to agree with this, that humans tend to, or there are some humans who tend to think of ways to abuse technology, and that's something that could lead to society's downfall.
The problem has not been technology per se. Humans, as I, all of what we're going to talk about, I've written in the book, so of course I amplify it and put it in context within the book. In this interview, we take snapshots, so to speak, verbal snapshots. The problem with technology has not been its imagining and its use, but in rather consistent disregard of the ecological consequences. Humans, the oceans, we thought were endless, and even now we treat the ocean as if it were an infinite toilet. We treat fresh water as if there's an endless supply. We pretend that because it rains, well, gee, fresh water is limitless. So we pollute it with no regard that fresh water is in fact a non-renewable resource and very limited. When it comes to technological use, the metals were first used to chop down trees. The Middle East used to be a lush forest. It was very rich. And Iceland was also completely forested. The Vikings came in the 11th century and chopped all the trees down. And even with the technology we have now, because forests create their own environments to sustain themselves, our technology cannot recover the forest. So Iceland remains bare. So the problem has been that we've not respected nature. And we also have not sufficiently respected each other. In this book, I talk extensively about how men denigrated our better half, and that is women. Women, as I point out in the book, have greater social intelligence. They naturally, because they are nurturing by their being mothers, they have a sense of empathy and compassion. Women communicate to form bonds. Men communicate to promote themselves. And the world transitioned from being led by women to men when agriculture began. So, and of course, the reason that occurred was because agriculture required more physical strength. And so men started to dominate. When there was still a foraging lifestyle, women, because they were the ones who created the crafts, who knew which plants were helpful, which were nutritious, etc., they were the ones who educated youth. They had the power. And men took that power when they could. And that has been nothing but due to the diminishment of humanity. So the question is not technology per se. It's been a question of respect. And that respect relates to awareness. We simply haven't, humans still think they are a superior species. They don't seem to appreciate that plants obviously are much more intelligent than people.
You do touch on that in the book as far as plants being the self-sufficient species on Earth.
And plants have a special problem. If you're an autotroph, great, you can make your own food. But the problem with a plant is, of course, it's sessile. It can't move around. It's a seed. It has to sit and wait and say, well, gee, now's my time. And then it starts to sprout. It then grows according to its ambitions and its fears. Plants allocate their resources based on their perceived need for defense versus what they can afford to expend in ambitious growth. A plant has to do all kinds of complex mathematical computations in order to properly allocate its resources, which are minerals from its roots, and sunlight, and of course water, that it uses in its leaves for photosynthesis. It's got to go, when night comes, it doesn't have any more energy. So it's got to calculate, well, how much can I expend in order to get through the night? Same thing with seasonal droughts. What leaves you see all the time plants dropping leaves? Well, they drop leaves because they calculated that leaves compared to other leaves aren't holding their weight. So gotta let it go. And they turn brown because they're sucking back the nutrients into the plant. Tremendous number of calculations by plants. They also give fruit. They create toxins. Almost all of the medicines, even today, that we have come from plants. Plants have relationships with microbes. They know what's going on. They communicate at a molecular level, just like viruses and bacteria do. They can speak these many languages. Humans have barely comprehended that happens, let alone what those languages are.
Ishii Nobu is with me on Book Spectrum. We're talking about his new book, The Story of Humanity, Ecology and Consequence. I want to take a little, I'm not going to say issue, but I want to challenge a little bit your your idea that women might kind of run things a little better than men for a number of reasons. I'm not trying to be misogynistic as somebody who maybe have just heard this portion of the program and not really paid attention might think. The idea is, throughout your book, you discuss how power has corrupted man throughout the I'll even say eons, okay? So the idea is, while men held powerful positions over the years, you can say for the proportion of women in power in that period of time, we're going to have your share of Messalina Valerias or Emperor Zhang Qing's, maybe Elizabeth Bathory's, people like that. Power does corrupt both sexes, and power corrupts people, regardless of sex or background or anything. Had women been in power over the years, and men maybe not so much, you or a female version of you writing a similar book might have that same perspective. What are your thoughts about that particular observation?
Keep in mind that everything has, when we talk about sociality, we're talking about a cultural context. There have been numerous, the UK now has a British leader again, numerous leaders who have been women, but they have succeeded as women by essentially acting as men in a man's world. And so within that context, women, men, whoever, does the best they can. The context of men has been one of power. The context of women, sure, and I talk about this in the book, women have their own dominance hierarchies. Power, social power, is always an issue. But it's a question of the nuance. It's a question of the balance. Men would rule over others, as the history of politics shows, using force as a primary tool. Subjugation. Women, by their nature, have an inclination more towards cooperation, more towards, as the modern phrase goes, win-win, as opposed to domination by I take, you lose, I win, you lose.
Oh, fair enough. I'm sure Mary the First would have disputed that, but I get what you're saying. And again, this is from an alien race's point of view in observing our own history. And that is what it kind of looks like. That's important to note when reading the book. Another point about your book is you interestingly compare men and women of today to those of primitive bipedal tribes, civilizations throughout history, noting that we have a lot of the similar personality, social structures, and attitudes, and even innovativeness as our past ancestors. Having said that, not only have you pointed out humanity's strengths over the years as a fair balance, you bring up what did, or hypothetically, led us to extinction, our collective gullibility, eagerness to go to war, misuse of technology, as we discussed before, and materialism. These weren't phenomena of just today, but over man's history.
You summarized that extremely well. And one of the main points in this book is the continuum that history has been. And the conclusion of this book, Self-Extinction, comes from the rather simple observation that the wheels of civilization do not easily turn. We've been on this vector for a very long time, beginning with the invention of metal so that trees could be cut down, to the invention of vehicles that could drive on roads. We have consistently sought for convenience. We have consistently sought expediency. Winston Churchill observed that those things that seem wondrous to us now could be the source of our doom. And that is how it seems to be heading.
You made this CERN supercollider in Switzerland pop into my head because this is something that's fascinated us throughout the years, yet it's also something that could hypothetically destroy us if it creates one of those little tiny black holes that could swallow the Earth.
When they were building the atomic bomb, the developers, Oppenheimer, and others we're concerned that it might set off a chain reaction, an uncontrolled chain reaction. Yes, there have been concerns, and if we look through history, Hammurabi, who was the source of Babylonian law that basically established the code of if-then for writing laws, he regulated forced deforestation. There have been Emperor Wu in China, which I write about, tried to create a socialism that was equitable to all. And part of that was being judicious in allocating resources that were there. So, yes, there have been concerns that things could easily get out of control. And U Thant in 1969 at the UN said, and this is in the book, of course, we have 10 years before our human problems are likely to spiral out of control. So there have been leaders that have foreseen that the vector of history was not going to favor our continued survival.
Ishii Nobu was with me on Book Spectrum. We are talking about his book, The Story of Humanity, Ecology and Consequence. This from the eyes of an alien race who comes and sort of studies our civilization, our at that point extinct civilization, from an anthropological point of view. What do you want this book to be? Do you want this book to be sort of a third-party look at our history, or maybe a warning about potential abuses and resources and our own human fallibilities that we might be able to turn some of this around?
This book appears to be, facilely, because it is claimed to be written by aliens, this book appears to be a historical document from the future. The storyline is unequivocal and rather simple. Human history has been a continuum. The wheels of civilization do not easily turn. In the present perspective, the book's conclusion is a prophecy. One of the fun things that I had with doing this book was a forecasting model. I cut my teeth statistically. I was an economist in my first career and worked as an economic analyst and in econometric modeling for a power company, Georgia Power. So in this book, I wanted to, shall we say, get the numbers right, and it's kind of hidden. There are numerous graphs in this book. The one on sustainability, for example, in the last chapter, relied heavily upon the model for its predictions. My concern with the modeling for this book was in being too conservative, not being too foreboding. As I've written extensively in my blog about climate models, and as climatologists and scientists have repeatedly said through time, that the climate models have been too conservative, that they've underpredicted estimates for the warming that is accelerating. And of course, the reason that that has occurred with regard to climate models is because the feedbacks are more intricate and more tightly bound than what climate modelers first appreciated. And some of the dynamics occur distinctly from how they were imagined to occur. And part of that, a large part of that, has to do with observations. For example, on the poles, the North and South poles, the glacial caps are melting. Well, they figured the rate at which those caps were melting by using satellites looking down from above. But much of the melt has been underneath, from the warming waters that come up from the tropics, the currents that flow, and then thaw the ice from underneath. So they simply missed, by the perspective by which they could observe, what was really going on. Another aspect of that has to do with underreporting. Nations are not accurately reporting their warming emissions. Europe, just this year, said that methane is a green gas. They were going to ignore it. Almost every country, India is incredibly egregious in not reporting its warming emissions. So if you don't have good data, you're not going to have good models. and you don't know what's going on.
One would wonder how crazy everybody would get if we had this kind of media study capabilities and, of course, scientific capacity when we were heading towards an ice age instead of far away from one. Then people will be, you know, that's what I was thinking. So that would be interesting. I want to get to one more point here. Here we go. One thing that
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry. May I interrupt you? May I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
One of the points I would like to make regards, and I prepared for this interview thinking what kind of questions you might ask based on previous interviews you've had.
That's okay.
One of the questions I thought you might ask is what I'm trying to accomplish with this book.
You also lead me to wonder if we hadn't been visited by aliens for another reason. These fallibilities that our human race has had over the many, many years are, again, from ego problems to misuse of technology to everything you've listed in your book and you've gone through in detail. One would wonder if other similar beings to ours on similar planets to ours didn't advance enough to travel to other planets for the same exact reasons and found ways to extinct themselves.
I have not written about, I mean, other than using aliens as a device, I have not written about aliens, but I've been interested in aliens from the standpoint that there's ample documentation that governments have collected that we, the humans, Earth, has been visited by aliens. And they clearly, in order to do so, they have technology, I won't say beyond our imagination because our imagination has been fabulous.
Yeah. Yes.
But they certainly have advanced technology and they are observing us. And yet, as far as we know, they only observe and have not interfered with our civilization. The evidence seems to indicate that that is the case. It is a interesting question whether they ever have interfered and to what end are they watching us.
Interesting point. I did ask in the past, Ishii, if your book was kind of a warning to us about how we can kind of reverse what's happening. Aside from that, what else did you want to accomplish with the publishing of this book?
While the book is unequivocal, I think the story, the title of the book is The Story of Humanity. I think the story will be interpreted according to a reader's ideology, their open-mindedness. The illusion of knowledge is worn like a protective cloak. We are reluctant to accept the demise of humanity because, of course, it's a sense of loss. We have attachment to our culture, our own lives. Especially for those with compassion, the prospect of the end of humanity provokes that sense of loss. There was a very well-known book by Swiss-American psychologist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, published in 1969, titled On Death and Dying. In the book, Ross identified five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. In a context of self-extinction, hope is denial dressed up to look like a good thing. But hope is just self-induced blindness. Most of those willing to entertain that the end times are upon us have only moved to the second stage, anger. I see it on Twitter a lot.
Mm-hmm.
People are angry that, you know, fossil fuel companies and the rich, and they want to blame someone else.
Yeah, until they get rich. Until they get rich mouthing off on Twitter writing a book about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as Bruce Springsteen famously once wrote in his songs, poor men want to be rich men want to be kings, and a king ain't satisfied until he rules everything. There's a climate conference, another one, where they'll talk a lot of hot air will go out, but nothing will be done. Young people from developing countries are descending on this new climate conference. They say we're not victims, we are going to be a force, and of course, what they're going to be a force doing is acting like victims, saying, well, gee, we're innocent. Aren't we entitled to something for being innocent and being caught in this? So that's the third stage, which is bargaining. They have that sense of loss, but they want to bargain for something out of it.
If you think about it, the bargaining seems to make sense from their point of view. And again, from your point about the five stages of grief. On the other hand, you're bargaining with people who are talking about the climate, yet many of them are lining their pockets over what they're trying to dictate to the rest of us. And they're the false prophets, which could also lead to our demise.
No disagreement there. So what the book is about is acceptance. The only way to get to acceptance is to see the future as inevitable, a fate already set. Read properly, that's where the book takes you. And I walk through in the book, according to the book, we're at 2022. I set the time frame of the book as at the end of this century is the date of zero. I use a calendar that's a countdown calendar in order to give a better sense of the proximity in which events occurred. According to the book, we've only got less than 80 years right now before humans are extinct.
Well, Ishii, keep in mind that when the book of Revelations was written, people thought the end of times was coming close to then, or relatively close to then, and it hasn't happened yet. Nostradamus, according to translations, predicts the world's going to end in 3797. However, and this is in accordance with your book, where I would say it's a futurist writing from aliens' point of view, looking back at what we did to ourselves. Maybe it's a warning, but also the idea, and again, Nostradamus said this, man has the power to change the predicted future.
1648, Swedish statesman Alex Osternerna said, behold, with how little wisdom the world is governed. What's really changed since then? The answer is really nothing.
Yeah, not much.
If anything, it's gotten worse. Democracy is a surefire formula for ensuring doom. Consider how authority is granted in modern states. An electorate grants rule for a very limited time, 5 years or less. In the U.S., a president has only a 4-year term. If a ruler has not appeased or hoodwinked the citizenry in that short time, he's turfed out. What that means is rulers are on a short leash. Their time horizon is an election cycle. Such a system of governance is built for myopia and short-termism. For all practical purposes, modern governance is designed to be conservative. Radical action never gets anywhere near the calculation of what to do. The threat of global warming and it's the pollution that caused it, the burning of fossil fuels, has been known to lead to a terminal end at least since the early 1960s.
Keep in mind, Ishii, that the worst polluters in the world have leaderships that are by definition almost lifetime, or at least very hard to get rid of their leaders, like China and India for that matter. So on the other hand, the nations that pollute the least are the republics, the so-called democracies, where leaders can only stick around for a short period of time, whereas the ones that can stick around for a longer period of time, they're the major polluters.
I disagree completely. It does vary case by case. India is one of the worst polluters, as is Pakistan. The USA is hands down the worst polluter in the world.
Well, behind China too.
China is in second place. Now, let's look at China very carefully here. China is in second place. In 1981, China changed its regime. Mao died, and Deng took over, and they went to capitalism. They became the world's factory. Well, becoming the world's factory necessarily meant they accepted a lot of pollution, and they generated a lot of pollution because they wanted to become a world power, and that was their way to do it. But if you look at where Xi Jinping is leading China now, he is taking it in a different direction. Growth is going down. He's done a lot to limit the growth of coal, although they're still using it. He's the only country, China's the only country in the world with a food waste policy. So it's a very mixed picture. But I think what we both agree on is that political leaders, clearly the trend continues. Political leaders are not stopping the growth in pollution. They're not asking the question, that's most essential, and that is, does this system work? Is it a sustainable system? And plutocratic capitalism clearly is not a sustainable system. So I think you and I are not discussing the endpoint so much as talking about the timing. When is the tipping point that it's unrecoverable, that humans will die out?
And that's the question: inevitability or something we can prevent? Species, if they cannot survive in their environment, become extinct. We can talk about the dinosaurs till the cows come home, but the cows are still here. So are roaches, by the way. Roaches, for some reason. That's a good question. Are the roaches still around, according to the aliens that write your book?
I would think that roaches would be around. They have been highly adaptable. Roaches have been around for at least 240 million years. And so they're kind of like the equivalent of sharks. They've changed some, but very little during their evolution. And there also has not been a large radiation of species in roaches compared to other insects.
Interesting point.
Bees have also been highly successful. Bees descended from wasps about 210 million years ago, and there's not been a tremendous number of them either.
I do want to point out that in the book you do bring up that there is still life here. This is not a, I think I referred to it being a barren planet, but I meant bereft of human existence at the time. But you did make sure that the world would have, or at least the world as described in the book, would have animal life and plant life still thriving on Earth.
There's been identified so far. It's a difficult science, geology, and the unearthing what occurred in life history. And one of my books is on that, has the elements of evolution, has Earth's life history. There have been identified 11 major mass extinction events. There have been dozens and dozens, perhaps even 100 mass extinction events of severe consequence. The current mass extinction event is unusually short and sharp. It may exceed, in terms of population declines, the Great Dying, which occurred 252 million years ago. It certainly will exceed dinosaurs going extinct, and I'll come back to dinosaurs in a minute. But what's going to happen, as is typically happened, is larger animals get the worst of it. In the case of the current extinction, humans go, and of course humans wiped out megafauna millennia ago. They killed off mastodons and saber-toothed tigers, etc. So those are already gone. But insect populations now are down 90% and bird populations, a lot of animals that we don't keep track of, down over 90% from what they were two centuries ago. The oceans, it's even worse than it is on land. Of course, we don't monitor the oceans like we do on land. But in all these extinction events, as with the current one, there will be animals that survive, especially the smaller ones. Rodents will survive, most likely. And extinction events affect the least, historically, plants. And so a lot of plants will survive. And then the question is recovery. Well, the engine of extinction has been technology. It's been these polluting fossil fuels. Once that engine dies, that opens the possibility for Earth to cleanse itself, which it naturally will do. We're still talking a million years or more, but relatively rapid compared to previous events. such as that have geological causes, such as the bolide. There were two bolides that struck that extinguished the dinosaurs. And a point to keep in mind is dinosaurs were already transforming and their numbers were declining considerably before those bolides hit. There was a considerable reduction in dinosaur numbers and in species about 113 million years ago, and they were transforming. Birds were starting to come to the fore even before the bolides took the large dinosaurs out. So nature transforms, but it does survive.
Once again, the book is The Story of Humanity, Ecology and Consequence. It's very interesting looking at our society from a, even if it's fictional, onlookers or maybe scientists' point of view. What will happen after the extinction of humanity on Earth? How will other societies see us if they come here and find a humanless existence? What will they see with what we left behind? What will they translate as to what we've done and the marks we left? Find out about all of that in Ishinobu's book, The Story of Humanity, Ecology and Consequence. I want to thank you for being with us, Ishi.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Where can somebody find your website to learn more about you and the past books you've written?
My books, all of my other books, are available directly on my website, ishinobu.com. I also have extensive writings through my blog, and there are numerous podcasts that I have on my website.
Excellent. Once again, thank you very much for being with us, Ishinobu. The book, as I had just said a few moments ago and several times, The Story of Humanity, Ecology, and Consequence. I'm Chris Cordeni. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.